This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because of the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Well, hello, and welcome to our show tonight. We're very, very pleased to be able to welcome a young man who has just returned from a tour of duty in Iraq. And Rick Stevens is here with me tonight. Rick?
Elaine, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Where are you tonight?
I'm in Chicago, looking forward to the conversation.
Good. Well, I'm actually in California, and our guest is Mike New. He is a gentleman well known to me and somewhat known to Rick now. We were just very pleased to be able to attend a welcome home celebration for Michael's return from a tour of duty in Iraq. And I want to make it very clear to our audience tonight that we're not here to discuss the Iraq War. But what we do want to do is we want to bring our soldier home. We want to hear your heart. We want to hear how the war and your participation in your duties and your actions shaped how you thought about where you were and then when you came back. Now that you're back here, you've only been back a short time. But I know in our conversation just recently, you were telling me about how your perspective has really been affected. And so if you would start out with a little bit of background on yourself, what you're doing now, what you did before you left, what your feelings were when you took off, give us some insight into what that experience was like.
Well, I had a lot of events kind of come rushing at me right before I got deployed. I was given about 3 months of a heads up about a year ago. I'm thinking about March 2009. I got, the dreaded phone call saying, hey, guess what, you're going. And some of the things that I was looking at that time, I had just gotten married. I got married the previous September. So I was, just starting down the road with my wife on building our relationship. And I was kind of anticipating that kind of phone call, but it was more of in the back of my mind. You know, Every soldier has that anticipation of going off to war, but when it actually comes, you have this big rush of emotions and feelings. So I just started with my wife, and we were kind of looking more like dreaming for a house. And I got that phone call, and we went into turbo mode on finding one because I wanted to get her something permanent in anticipation of leaving. We were also looking for a pet. We wanted to have that, that third party in our relationship to kind of build on. So we were looking for a dog. We had a house. We had just gotten married. I was not very far into my current job, which I work for city government here in College Station, Texas. I work as a multimedia coordinator. I'm on the website. I do publishing and all that. And we're starting to build my career and my position where I work. So we're doing a lot of things, and everything was kind of going in turbo speed. And when that phone call came, I had a lot of emotions rushing through me. And given about 3 months, it didn't seem like enough time to put a halt on a lot of things and close a lot of doors that I had started to open. So right about when I took off, I deployed in early July. And in that 3 months, I bought a house. We found a dog. We got our finances together and settled, and we made a lot of things happen that normally we usually just kind of put off and take months to complete. So a lot of stress for me and my wife. We have friends in the community, and we've worked in the community for a while, but, you're never as close to people as you try to get when when you're thinking that you're going to be gone for a long time. So we had a lot of help in that respect. And with all of our issues going on, we did find some support in the community for that as well. But definitely a lot of motion going on heading into that deployment.
And what was your actual job? How did you prepare for going? What did they take you, and what were some of the steps to getting out to your actual assignment?
Well, the Army, with a broad brush, provides pre-mobilization training, as they call it, for any soldier that's being mobilized within a unit. This includes active Army and National Guard and Army Reserve, all are components of the big Army. And when they call a unit, and my particular unit, up for a deployment to deploy in July, we go through periods of pre-training to prepare for that. So we do a lot of, you know, battle drills. We focus on a lot of basic weapon skills, which all of that, for a part-time soldier, for a National Guard soldier like me, each time we do that training, again, it's pulling me away from my job. It's pulling me away from my family. And, you know, I'm starting to gradually separate myself and prepare to be away from them for a very, very long time. So we did a couple of weeks in one part of Texas where we worked on battle skills and battle drills. And then just before we left, we had a couple of days of lots and lots of PowerPoint. Death by PowerPoint is the term we always like to use over there. Lots of PowerPoint and sessions and training and classes and lots of information thrown at us to help us kind of gauge and prepare right before we left. So,
but
still very busy right before.
You weren't a career soldier, though.
No, I mean, no. Typically, most people would equate, you know, those soldiers that deploy as being active Army soldiers, as in they are serving in the military in a full-time capacity.
Okay.
My role is a little bit unique, that I serve the National Guard, which means I'm a member of the Texas Army National Guard. So the Texas Army National Guard is basically managed by the state government. But when we're in campaigns like Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, we basically are federalized. We're called up to serve in a federal role.
I see. Okay. So the emotions that you felt were not from someone who had been preparing all along as a part of your career to go into a war situation, but something that just came about as a result of your being prepared to serve.
Right. And, you know, from the very beginning, when I joined the National Guard in 2006, I joined for a lot of reasons. I wanted to serve my country. I was considering the idea of law school and really just wondering how in the world I was going to pay for it. And the National Guard provided benefits that would allow me to not only pay off my current education, but possibly give me an avenue into a new one. So those are the kind of the background into the reasons that I joined. All with, you know, each time with the intention or with the idea that I might be called up to go to Iraq or Afghanistan or some other country and serve in that federal capacity. But again, you know, it's always in the back of your mind. You're kind of thinking about it, but then, you know, my family and my civilian job, they all kind of, they take away from my attention. So, you know, getting that phone call, I was somewhat prepared. But again, it's always a shock when you get that.
Rick, you were a captain in the Marine Corps. Isn't that correct?
I was. I spent 5.5 years in the Marine Corps as an artillery officer.
But you went in thinking that you were going to be full-time military. Is that correct?
I expected to go on a career. The Navy, through a Naval ROTC scholarship, paid all of my college tuition. It's the only way I could afford to go to college. So the U.S. government was great to me, and then I had a commitment to serve on active duty afterwards, between active and reserve 6 years. And then in which I did, I served. My last duty station was Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And so I was expected, like everyone else, to be ready for deployment at a moment's notice. I was with the 1st Marine Division at Camp Pendleton in an artillery battery. And then my next duty station was Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, after training. And I came out of active duty after that, one in reserve duty. So I well understand what Mike's talking about. You may always get that call when you're wearing the uniform to go and serve at the pleasure of the president and at whatever action may be necessary. So it's a tough environment, but I compliment Mike for standing up to say, hey, as a member of the community, whether it's local, you know, in Texas or at the national level, it's something we all have an obligation to do, because, you know, what we enjoy here in America doesn't come for free. Someone has to serve and protect our freedom.
That's right.
Mike, when you got overseas, what was the role that you played over there?
You know, I just told you that one of the ideas that I was considering when I joined the National Guard was law school. And I'm still considering that option, but it led me, when I joined the Guard, to fulfill a role of paralegal. The occupational specialty is 27 Delta paralegal. So my primary duties when I was deployed were working under a pair of judge advocates for the 36th Sustainment Brigade out of Temple, Texas. We were basically the law center for the entire base there at the air base in southern Iraq, one of a few. But our primary role included military justice issues. Anytime there were contracts on base, I was like the administrator to help process that legal paperwork. If there was disciplinary action that needed to be taken in units that were under us, then we helped process that. And we also acted as a legal center to assist soldiers with a lot of their personal legal issues, like family separation papers, wills, powers of attorney. We kind of assisted in a lot of different pieces of the legal puzzle. So we were quite busy in a lot of diverse ways.
Really, the role that you had then is the Army's providing support to itself, its own infrastructure, whether it's on the JAG side, military justice or discipline or support for the troops. You really, in essence, created a community there of legal advice to be able to support any and all that came to you. You're really creating a community on your own. So I suspect not only did you have your job to do, but you had the living conditions to be able to get set up to operate as a community like you would anywhere else, but certainly in a different environment. Can you maybe describe a little bit about the living conditions?
I was actually quite surprised of the living conditions. I kind of anticipated what a lot of folks usually do is, you know, we're in tents, we're in the sand, we're in the heat. You really have no air conditioning. Those were my anticipations, and there was some of that for a lot of temporary housing and makeshift housing. We did have that. We were in tents. There was no air conditioning to some respect, but this particular base, because we have had a presence in Iraq for some time, there's a little bit more permanent housing infrastructure. We actually stayed in what we called containerized housing units, which we referred to as CHUs. Every room was our own CHU, which is basically just four walls of metal about dorm room size with a little cot and a space to throw all your junk in the corner. And it was all air-conditioned, usually box air-conditioning units, and you'd bounce around from makeshift building to makeshift building. And that's we kind of built a small city that way. You know, imagine a base that can house about 3,000 soldiers on a continual basis. It gets quite large when you think about it. It's not just a series of a dozen or two dozen tents. It's quite an interesting feat for something that can be done in a short time.
So you were able to get in, focus on your work, and have a reasonable infrastructure under which to get that done, which certainly important given the work that you were doing on the overall legal aspects of supporting what's going on over there.
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of our legal work came out of the fact that we've built such an infrastructure in that area. Some of the contracts that we're dealing with involve things going on around the base, and our work as the Army in communicating with the Iraqi populace, the Iraqi contractors that are working side by side with us. And with that infrastructure, we were able to kind of branch out and help rebuild infrastructure around Iraq. It's very interesting.
What kind of support or activity, or was there any emphasis at all on the unit, y'all forming a community among yourselves, or were you automatically assumed to jump in and become part of the community in which you were housed?
All the pre-training, you know, we are part of a unit. My role, and in fact, a lot of soldiers' roles within the National Guard are unique because we're really plucked out of one life, our civilian life, our life that we live in normal towns and cities, and then we're plucked into this military life. And I specifically was placed into this unit. I really didn't know more than maybe about one or two other soldiers. We're plucked into that unit, and we're there with them for the rest of the year, for as long as our deployment stands. So we really had to bond as a family, not just within our unit, but once we got to the area we were located, we had to bond with other units. We had to build camaraderie and the kind of administrative operational infrastructure with personnel, with other soldiers, with active duty soldiers, with Army Reserve soldiers that were all there serving together, even with Air Force and with the Iraqi contractors that had been there longer than us. You know, all of it was trying to build and maintain relationships, and that gets hard when you have units, especially within the military, and this is how deployments work, that go in, they stay for a year, they stay for 6 months, or they stay for 8 months, and then they leave, and you got a whole new group of people. They stay for 6 months, they stay for a year, and they leave. All this bouncing back and forth, it tends to put some strain on how those relationships are maintained and built.
Interesting. In terms of how you went forward with those relationships among yourselves, there were no specific attention paid to that. That was just assumed that you would do that. Is that correct?
Right. Funny thing about the Army is a lot of things are assumed, and it's assumed that you can jump into your role, my role as a paralegal, and anyone's role, whatever their occupational specialty may be, that they're able to jump into that role just as if they were an active duty soldier, just as if they were doing that full time, including a lot of, you know, the military rules and regulations and a lot of the operations and the drill and ceremony type activities that are expected of a soldier regardless. You're expected to know those right off the bat. And we go through pre-training and everything to prepare us for that. But to be able to jump into those roles, you've really got to be on your toes and be ready to do that on point, because it does matter. We're, especially in the kind of situation we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've got to stay on top of things so we don't lose time. We don't want to spend any more time than we have to in those areas.
Probably to that point, and we'll talk about this after the break, but what was really important being a part of the National Guard, you went through boot camp, I presume, and where you learned the fundamental language, values, and the sense of perspective about what the Army's about, and which we talk about as core, about what communities are all about, as you established, you used the word relationship, the relationship with others in their community. When we come back from the break, Mike, let's continue in that discussion, because it's an important element of whether the communities are overseas or here in America or it's your local hometown. These are the important elements that allow communities to be successful. This is Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott with our terrific guest today, Mike New. We'll be right back after the break. Well, welcome back. This is Rick Stevens with Elaine Scott, and our terrific guest today, Mike New, who recently returned from Iraq. Our focus today is not about the Iraq War. Our focus is on about what Mike did in his role as a citizen soldier, and particularly focusing on the community that he was part of. You know, once he was deployed, Mike, just before the break, we talked about, you know, the analogy about, you know, boot camp and this alignment around language, values, vision, which is what boot camp for the Army is all about. Maybe describe, you know, your sense about what you went through after you became part of the National Guard and, quote, going through boot camp, and how it helped prepare you for what you then saw when you went to Iraq and you jumped into a position as a citizen soldier who's not living day in and day out about what you learned back then, but certainly had to learn to apply it in a way that was supportive of the new community that you were a part of.
Well, from watching movies and everything, you get an idea or a sense of the boot camp environment with drill sergeants yelling in your ear and, you know, trudging through the mud and getting yelled at just every day on a constant basis. And when I went through that training, you know, some of the things I was familiar with, but on a consistent basis, we were stressed, we were pushed, we were rushed, we were forced to make decisions, whether or not we felt like they were the right decisions or not. We had to make one, and it had to be now. And that consistency and that part of the training, I wasn't ready for. And I really had to teach myself to make decisions in a snap and to do the things that I just kind of mull over and eventually get to or procrastinate over. But specifically that training, really prepared me in my deployment to be able to make decisions just on a dime and do things without thinking, do it instinctively and do it right each time. And that comes with repetition. So a lot of our training is some of the minute details, especially in weapons training, where your exact movements, your breathing patterns, everything is done exactly the same way, and it's done over and over and over, so that when the time comes, and in rare instances it comes, but when it does, you're prepared, and you can do it without thinking. And sometimes, you kind of have paralysis when you're trying to make decisions, and especially big ones. And they're all big ones in Iraq, and they're all big ones in that type of environment. And you don't want to hesitate. So that's what that training really prepared me for in my deployment. And I've taken a few of those values back home with me, too.
Which ones?
Being able to make a decision. I tell you that because before going through some of that military training, I would really back off from decision making. I would kind of back off from taking a stand on something. And, you know, what that created was it ended up creating a life around me and the people around me I really had no control over or say of my own, that I was simply, you know, following this person and following that person. And at some point in your life, you make a decision that, okay, I'm going to go this direction and I'm going to do it. And I'm going to listen, but I'm still going to be my own person. And that's really the direction that my National Guard training and that boot camp stressed, that regardless, things may be tough, but you've got to stay focused on your goal. And I think that's what that's done for my job here. And I've come back working at the city now with a little bit more confidence and a little bit more eagerness to start making things happen rather than kind of reacting to situations.
How much of that do you see going on around you? Do you recognize that now that you didn't recognize before?
You know, a lot of the ideas that had come about, especially working in a city government, you've got to go through, in any government entity, any bureaucracy really, you've got to go through a lot of stages to see a project or an idea from scratch actually grow into fruition to what its true nature is going to be. And with all those steps, it tends to dilute the process. It tends to wear you down, and you tend to lose motivation in that respect. It's given me, coming back from that deployment, it's given me a little bit of patience and a little bit of pride when I try and take any idea that I have or any project that I've started to see it to the end. And I try not to get distressed or worried or apathetic about those situations and those projects, because I'm definitely more familiar with how bureaucracy works, having been in a deployment with the Army. Boy, if you ever want to deal with red tape, join the Army. But I've worked through that, and now coming back to the city, I can kind of familiarize myself with the system and make it easier not only to get the project done, but to make it what I want it to be. And that's the real key.
What we're looking at here is some things that you're talking about that are not taught. They are not, I would dare say, you didn't learn any of that in college or anywhere else.
No, it's hard to take a class in motivation. Yeah, a lot of soldiers that serve, they serve for various reasons, but There's an inner drive, there's an inner desire, not only to serve their country because they believe in this system. And many, many, many people will criticize it for many reasons, but they believe in the system, and they want to do good things, and they have great ideas. There are a good number of those. And to teach someone to be motivated and to desire something is rather hard to do. A lot of that is really instilled in all of us, but to bring that out, and for some folks, it's boot camp in the Army. For other folks, you know, it's working under a nonprofit organization. For other folks, it's working for a city or state government. For everyone, it's different, but in a lot of cases, that inner person is revealed when you start to participate in these types of things. And most people don't realize it until they do it. They may be forced into it for one reason or another, but public service is an unending challenge, and that's the nature of it. It has to serve equally. It has to serve fairly, and that's an incredible challenge when you try to put that into action.
And as you watched it unfold before you, did you see young men who were or women who responded better than others to the challenge?
Absolutely. I told you we provided a lot of legal services, personal legal services for soldiers, and in coordinating with their families and in coordinating with entities and parties back home. Soldiers had a lot of things going on back home, and when you can't control home by being in the environment that we're in, when you can't control things back home, things that were fragile before become more fragile. Things that were strong before tend to become stronger. And seeing how some soldiers dealt with it, you saw if they had strong families, if they had a strong relationship with even one person back home, then they were able to deal with the situations and the challenges that came up. Those that were maybe struggling on their own or had other issues before they deployed were having a much harder time dealing with that. And that all goes back to the types of relationships that they had built up before leaving.
So from an overall perspective, what I think I hear you talking about is relationships central to any community, no matter whether you're in the U.S., whether you're in the military, whether you're deployed. Relationships are central because they establish a couple things. One is frame of reference when stress is induced into a process, which it always is. And the second is this notion about consistency in a relationship as you be able to press forward. And I think that's an important element as we talk about, in no matter what community it is, to be able to have people participate and engage and to be able to make those communities where people really want to be, despite the fact that, people don't want to be in Iraq on the military side. Being there, having those relationships really was an important part of success in everyone's deployment.
And that was a real strength for me. Not only my wife, who I love to death, I was able, and because of the infrastructure that we had in the area I was in Iraq, I was actually able to get online and talk to her through Skype. I was able to have a conversation with her almost every day. A great blessing. And even if we had nothing to say, even if it was just dead air, me breathing and her breathing, I knew she was okay, and I knew she was there, and if there was any situation or problem or issue that came up, we could at least talk to each other about it, more than just email. We could just talk to each other about it. But even the relationships within my unit, those were strong. Some were rough, and challenges occur for all of us, but for the most part, we really had to join together, and keeping those relationships allowed me to separate my military experience and my civilian experience back home and kind of maintain that bond so that when I came back, I wasn't just jumping into a whole nother world again. And I give credit to all of the friends and family of soldiers that are deployed. I have yet to see someone who has not been very supportive that's been a friend or family member of a soldier. And I get a lot of that support. I get support from folks around my community just saying, hey, thank you for your service. And even if that's all they can say, I know that when the time comes where they can do more, they will, because they want to. They support our role. Regardless of the politics, they support our role.
An interesting point you raised on this notion, I'd like to, if you don't mind, delve in a little bit between email versus talking on Skype. One is the reading the text back and forth, which certainly is always helpful, but you were fortunate to be in a situation where you could Skype back and forth, and you clearly chose, to talk back and forth with your wife. A lot of our youngsters today we see growing up, struggle with this verbal communication back and forth, and they actually prefer to text or to email. What was your sense about, your peers as you're over there? Did more tend to want to talk on the phone, or were there any conclusions, or am I just headed on a path where there's, not much there, but clearly you and your wife focus on the talking side?
We did. I always prefer a voice over a name. And I'm a face person. I recognize faces more than I do names. But we did have a lot of soldiers who had, cell phone shock. They get their phones don't work over there. I mean, there are ways of communicating, and those ways were video conferencing online or talking through internet phone or emailing. So a lot of the texters were having a bit of shock. They couldn't have their cell phone right next to them and be able to text each other every day. So those soldiers and those particular people that we worked with did have a difficult time because in a lot of instances you're away from that and you're forced to give orders, you're forced to take orders, you're forced to deal with challenges by talking and communicating to other soldiers within the unit, within our operations. And, you know, soldiers, especially in stressful situations, tend to be very short, very blunt, and very to the point. And for someone that is used to only texting or only doing something without seeing facial emotions or gestures or dealing with the everything else when it comes to speaking with others, you saw that. And it's very evident and visible, and it's hard to communicate knowledge and expertise in dealing with people directly. You just don't get training like that. It's something that comes with experience and again repetition over and over. So we did do a lot more talking and engaging personally than we did texting or emailing.
That was just because of the way that the environment was set up. Is that correct?
Sure. I mean, I was forced to do it, obviously, with my wife in some instances back home. But, you know, when an order is given, we emailed in some cases when it bounced from base to base. But a lot of times you walk down to tent number 3 and you gave orders to Private Joe. And Private Joe walked down to tent 7 and communicated those orders to all his buddies. So that the word was passed down when things needed to get done. And then word was passed back up when there were challenges or obstacles. And, you know, initially in the pre-training and leading up to the deployment, of course, I'd never met these folks. I'd never met the other soldiers. I'd never met my bosses. I'd never met my subordinates. So there's always a little bit of walking on eggshells when you first start to meet these people. How are they going to react to maybe my sense of humor? How are they going to react to the way that I give orders or the way that I receive orders? You know, how am I going to gauge this person or that soldier? And how am I going to get my message communicated to them effectively? I can't just say it because just saying it isn't enough. It's the gestures I use. It's the tone that I use. And it's the action that follows that command or that request that really brings the meaning to our communication. And that's something, I guess, that I observe just from my communications background. But it's something that's very interesting to me that I observed in many, many different ways in how we interacted as a unit while we were over there.
What kind of marks would you give? Did you get better as you got there? Did soldiers get better as they were there?
Well, what tended to happen was, you know, those soldiers that you saw, they would maybe look past a lot of the bravado and the gesturing of being in the Army, of being in the military. You know, there tends to be a family relationship, and, you know, you can kind of let your guard down a little bit on communicating in very rigid and very strict ways. And other soldiers follow the book. You know, they go by the book and giving orders and receiving orders and their correspondence. So you see the personalities of people and how they interact in that, you know, in that military environment. And those personalities are reflected in the ways they communicate. Our unit, I think, was effective in that way. I mean, we stayed together. Everyone made it out safely, and we accomplished our objectives. So in that way, we were successful. But there was always, you know, there's always obstacles here and there that kind of tested those waters a little bit.
That's pretty crucial. I understand that you made a personal effort to get to know some of the people, the Iraqi people in the community, and that you felt compelled to share with them some of your own native culture. Is that correct?
That's true. Some of my additional roles, in addition to my paralegal work, of course, when I started in my deployment, I was a specialist, and I was since promoted to sergeant during my deployment. But when I was fulfilling some of those roles, one of them included escorting contract workers around the base to do some of the smaller jobs, you know, picking up trash around the base, doing a lot of groundwork and transportation work, and just some of these smaller jobs that involve a lot of additional labor. So in our effort to work with the Iraqi people, we as soldiers would escort maybe a handful or two handfuls of them around the base to work on whatever they were working on with the contractor. So there was, in between these work periods, there was times where I could just hang out with them and maybe talk to them a little bit for what little English some of them knew. And so I decided that I would introduce, you know, a little bit of Texas culture to them.
And we'll fill you in on the type of culture that Michael was managing to impart to these wonderful Iraqi people. We'll be right back.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
Okay, so now please just tell me, what song was it that you taught the Iraqi people to sing along with?
All right, well, I'm from Texas. I like my country music, and I like all kinds of music. But, you know, I was talking what little I could with them, and I was speaking with a translator on one particular occasion, and I said, well, do you know any English music? Do you know any American music? Oh, no, I know nothing. So I said, well, let me teach you a song. And so I started to sing All My Exes Live in Texas by George Strait. You familiar with that song?
Yes.
Okay.
What a song to teach a group of
and it was the strangest thing. I don't know why it came to me, but I decided that was the song. So I started singing. I said, okay. And I'm talking to the interpreter at this point. Repeat after me. All my exes live in Texas. Go ahead. All my, sir, yes. All my exes live in Texas. Live in Texas. And so then he would translate to the group, about 8-10 other Iraqis. So he'd repeat it, la 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 la, and of course he's speaking Arabic at this point, and they repeat. So we all together. All my exes live in Texas. But what they did was they added a little bit of their own culture to it. So they would sing it as rough as they could. All my exes live in Texas. And then they would do this dance. They would stand up and they would kind of go around in circles and la 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 la. All my exes live in Texas. La 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 la. Oh, it was great. It was great.
God, I think it's great. I mean, that's just the song that you want a bunch of people to sing when they're in another country.
Now, of course, I didn't go into the depth and meaning of what all my exes live in Texas actually means, and they were just singing the words, but they were having a good time, and so was I.
Yeah, well, I think that was hysterical because I remember having been in the Middle East and having and listening to that when you said that before, when I heard you say that. I don't think I ever figured out what that was. I guess it's just like
well, you know, it's hard to create a visual image of that, but you know, imagine those little hand chimes and almost like a belly dancer would dance around and kind of twirl. That's what these guys mm-hmm. were doing. It was hilarious. I mean, these guys were pretty funny.
This quickly and have, but I also remember that out of respect, in spite of the great joy that you got in teaching that and the humor behind it, that you very tenderly said you, while you could videotape it and possibly even put it up on YouTube out of respect to the people that you were with, you would not do that.
Oh no. I mean, it's very difficult, especially now, to go over there and try to keep information concealed, considering the technologies that we have. I mean, we had internet access, but even that had to be very carefully guarded, because one thing that we can't anticipate is, you know, who's out there with maybe a target on these particular contract workers who may seemingly look like they are working, you know, maybe subversively for the government. It's a danger that we didn't want to inflict upon these folks that were heartily helping us and helping their own country out. So I didn't videotape it, although I would have liked to. It would have been a great YouTube video.
So keeping that in mind, and keeping in mind what you observed, there were some things that you observed as an American. There were things that you observed as a student of your college there at Texas A&M. But talk about your thoughts, the sort of the things that we were discussing, some things about how you felt over there, and you said, I think there were some things I learned about how we operate that maybe if I went back to the College Station, or I went back to my country, I would want kids to know these things about other countries first before we deployed them, or the kind of consideration that we have about the ways in which we approach helping other countries. What are things that you might do differently now that you've had that experience?
Well, you know, it's hard to put myself in that place and assume that role, considering that, you know, I don't have all the facts and the figures in front of me. But from my experience, you know, one of the things that I would suggest to anybody is, especially if they're in a role to make the kinds of decisions that led us into that arena, listen, because there are a lot of things that we've learned just by being there, just by simply having our presence there and learning speaking with the community. It's kind of like intelligence gathering. A lot of things we've done have been decisions that we've made and kind of passed on to the people of Iraq and other areas that really didn't involve an engaged two-way communication. In some respects, that couldn't happen. But in a lot of things that we do and we continue to do, it tends to be an our decision and you kind of deal with it way, where if there was more listening involved, if there was more engaging in the other party to help partner on decisions, to kind of go to a drawing board and draw up decisions with some involvement, with some participation in that, that's really the heart of what we do in my city government job. And people, when it comes down to it, one-on-one, people help make these things happen. So in a lot of ways, the challenge was getting not only supervisors and subordinates within our unit and within our infrastructure to listen to each other rather than having orders passed down. In most cases, you can avoid that, but a little bit of listening. When we have things going on, especially in a country as unique as Iraq, there's a lot of things that can be done in a way that supports both the Iraqi government and our own government. And I think we're getting to that point now. We may not have started that initially, but we're getting there. And it has involved a lot of inviting into our decision-making process.
Rick, isn't that something that we talk about all the time, though, that more people, as recognizing themselves as stakeholders, could benefit from learning what we're talking about when we do our process?
Well, there's no question, Elaine. As I'm listening to Mike talk, and I've been writing down some key words throughout our discussion over the last 45 minutes or so, this notion about relationships, critically important. This notion about inner drive and motivation, because as Mike pointed out, everyone has a sense of motivation, what they want to go do. And it certainly comes out in boot camp when you learn about, I got to make a decision now, maybe right or wrong, but I got to move forward because of that environment. This notion about public service as an important element, about gaining skills and capabilities, the importance about communication face-to-face. Email can be helpful, but this face-to-face, as Mike talked about, this inflection about what was his real intent and what did he mean by what he said about how he said it, the notion that culture is important, and then, as Mike alluded to early, this notion about listening and in creating this community that he was involved in. But we hear, as we talk about the importance of aligning community stakeholders, and we have to be able to listen to each other to really hear, to understand, because it gets back to this notion about what did we really understand, the meaning, the intent, this notion about shared or common language, so critically important. That's what I'm enjoying about this conversation is Mike's been walking through all the things we talk about and what it takes to create, you know, communities.
Well, and that's what I found fascinating when I talked to him immediately upon his return, because it's as if he somehow held in his hand and in his heart and in his brain an understanding that building community is not just a bunch of buildings. You had buildings, right, Mike?
Yeah, we built a small city in our base. We sure did.
But it was this face-to-face communication, relationships with each other, common vision, a set of goals, and sharing data and information about what needed to get done that allowed you to come together in a very short period of time, teach your neighbors funky music, right? No, I'm just kidding. And the idea, they will never forget that. You know that. People are going to come through and they're going to sing it for them.
Oh, man, I hope they ask someone else about it. That's going to throw them off.
That's going to be who taught you that is what we want to know. But what's important here is that you brought this home and now you're looking at it and you're asking yourself, how do you really realize you really have a brand new tool set or an awareness of a tool set of how to work? And you said it earlier, you talked about your job, but I think you've become, and we talked about this in our last show, something called the unintended stakeholder, the person who now understands that they can make things happen. But what we talk about in our work and our process is how do you now get other people to realize that role of being a stakeholder means actually listening to the other people.
Right, and I'll give you a real simple scenario of kind of what I'm talking about when I say listen. One example is when citizens come with problems here in our local government environment, they always, if they have a problem, they want to come to a regular council meeting and share that problem with the council, when in fact they're not familiar with how the meeting works, they're not familiar with how the process works, but they have a problem and they really need that problem fixed. If there was more of an awareness of the rules, learning how the game is played, learning how the system works, and kind of a step back, an absorption of knowledge and information, a gathering of intelligence before that decision is made, and that's just on a very simple level, then you can walk in with your problem, with your idea, with your initiative, with much firmer, with a much firmer grasp of how you can get your problem fixed or how you can get your idea off the ground. So that's really the core of it is there has to be a listening involved in the very beginning so that you know exactly what you're getting into.
I had that experience with a bunch of kids in school, 8 to 11 years old, who I told them I had them for a 10-week program and after school every day, and I said, I'll teach you anything you want to learn. And I didn't have a curriculum to teach them. I said, I want to know what you want to know. And what they told me was exactly that, Michael. They said they want to know how their city works. They said, we want to know where the stuff goes when you flush the toilet. We want to know who puts up the street signs and who gets to pick street names. Who mm-hmm. gets to pick them? Who gets to pick the place where we play soccer? Who gets to pick the park? the plays that are at the local community theater. They wanted to know how their community operated. For some reason, we keep that a mystery to most people. They have no idea how their city operates.
Well, and it wasn't until I left for Iraq and planted myself in the environment that I was in over there that I started realizing, holy cow, you know, all the things that just kind of blow by me when I'm here back at home. Streets, roads, curbs, parks, grass. There's no grass. There was no grass where we were. It was dirt and concrete. That was it. I've never seen so much brown in my life. But the landscaping, zoning, public facilities of any kind, you know, these are things that we have grown up with. We expect them. If we go to a city that doesn't have some of the perks that we lived with in one city, we downright demand it. But it's an expectation that was driven by, you know, our system of government and the way things work in our country. And to escape that for a period of time was a very amazing experience. It helped me realize the kind of complexity and the kind of work and challenges that are involved with even the very simplest of things to make our quality of life better in America.
We have learned to share as a nation. And not too long ago, we were talking to an accountant who was trying to give lessons in finances to a group of young people who were complaining miserably about how little money they had. And I said, how about asking them to stop and ask themselves the question, how many resources do they have that not very far outside the boundaries of this country people do not have, like libraries, all of the different kinds of things, the support that they have that simply don't exist anywhere else, mm-hmm. and they function. And I think that's what you're alluding to.
And, oh, absolutely. We take so much for granted, and we're not even really aware of it because we live in this environment that we're in. So it's harder for some to just take one step back and really look at it from someone else's shoes, maybe from an Iraqi's shoes or someone from another country's shoes, and saying, how is this different? You know, how can I look at this in a different way? And it's something right. We're not used to. It's something really that you've got to force yourself to do. But if you do, you end up, you really have a new perspective and a much more wholesome perspective on what you're looking at.
But they don't know that you have those things. So how did you come together as people? They didn't know what you had. What did they think you had?
You mean the Iraqi people?
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, we it was more of convincing. You know, we say, hey, we want to build a road. And they had versions of roads and schools and everything, but there was no underground plumbing. Well, how do we create the type of irrigation that we know can work in our country and we know can work in your country when there's a skill set that doesn't exist in some areas? So it's more of a, you know, let me help you, trust me that I know this. And they were very, since we've been there, the Iraqi people have been very accepting and very willing to learn how we do a lot of things and how we build a lot of the infrastructure that we've built so that they can take over and maintain it eventually. But it's hard. It's more of a trust me, I know what I'm doing concept, and it's hard to ask someone to be open to that. But fortunately, the Iraqi people were very open to that for the most part.
So you found an opportunity to teach them about things. But I think what your comment to me was at one point was that it was surprising as you thought about it, how much the people, how much we had to give at just at your age and where you were. You realized in many ways you had a lot of things to give and to share, but you couldn't, you know, infrastructure, legal systems, all sorts of things, because there was no infrastructure there to hold it up. And it had to be built. It had to be built from scratch. And it's something that, as you just said, we take for granted.
Right. I mean, it's easy for me to now, you know, walk down the hall with one of my colleagues and say, oh, I'll send you an email. Well, what if they don't have a computer? Oh, I'll write you a note. Oh, we don't have paper. Okay, then you got to figure out another way to do it. So that was a simplified version of a lot of the challenges that I know that other units and other soldiers had faced when they were presented with a problem. There were solutions that we could obviously introduce if we were in our country, but being in their country in a new land with new rules and new requirements, you got to start from scratch, and you got to be able to do it rather quickly. So that was a constant challenge that I think, especially my core boot camp training, just in its very nature, helped me prepare to do. And I think in a lot of instances, the public service role kind of forces that on you.
Has that inspired you in any way to continue doing more public service?
There is endless work in the public service field, I'll tell you that. Whether it's working for a local, state, or federal government, whether it's a nonprofit organization, the challenges are large and complex, and they're very exciting to me. So it's something that I'll probably continue for a long time.
Michael, you're absolutely wonderful, and I want you to know how much we both value and appreciate your service. But we also value the fact that you're willing to take the time to talk with us and let other people hear something about your experience.
Hey, I had a great time.
Thank you, Michael. We'll be back again next week. This is Elaine Scott and Rick Stevens for Birth to Work Radio.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.